Good afternoon. It's January 7th, 1985. This is the Business on Consumer and Business Affairs. We're meeting in Hearing Room F at the State Capitol. We have a public hearing today on overview of insurance industry, property, and casualty, a work session on House Bill 2284, and a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2303.
And she demands Business and Consumer Affairs Committee, come to order. We will have before us House Bill.
And it's the insurance.
We have an overview on insurance and the insurance industry and property and casualty.
Okay.
So, time back to that?
No more.
Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I'm Tom Bessonet with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. I represent Oregon Mutual exclusively, the insurance lobby on the property and casualty side, which basically is the liability insurance, automobile insurance, and that type, as well as fire insurance for home buildings, are represented by Safeco Insurance Company, by Farmers Insurance Company, and by North Pacific Oregon Auto, not to be confused with Oregon Mutual. Then we have three trade associations. Two of them are represented, one by Willard Fox, an attorney in Salem here, and the other one represented by John Powell. I think basically I wanted to review the mandatory auto insurance that is in effect in the state of Oregon, because I'm sure that your constituents are interested in that, and the better grounded you are, the better able you are to explain to them maybe what's going on. Actually, Oregon has two concepts of mandatory insurance. One is mandatory insurance, as we call it, which is in reality voluntarily. There is very little policing done on that type of insurance, and therefore we have quite a few people running around the state of Oregon that in fact do not carry liability insurance on their automobiles. Then we have what we call a Financial Responsibility Act, which is those individuals that have been caught driving without insurance or having an automobile crash or having a DUI or some other violation that requires the insurance company that insures them to make a filing with the state of Oregon that they do in fact have an insurance policy on that car and that it does meet the state requirements. That's called an SR-22 filing, as we call it, in the terminology of motor vehicles as well as the insurance industry. And that cannot be canceled without notification to the State Motor Vehicle Division. Even if they don't pay their premium, we still have to notify MVD that that policy has lapsed. The state law requires that policy or that person be insured for 3 years duration after the requirement that they be insured. So the citizens of Oregon are therefore basically guaranteed that those individuals will be insured for the next 3 years. The law also requires, and if you want to interrupt at any time, don't hesitate to interrupt me and ask a question.
Thank you. I'll take that. Have plenty, Tom. Tom, are you talking about an individual who has committed an infraction or had an accident, and we're talking about insuring the automobile? How do you hook those two together so that we know that the individual is that's driving the car and the car are the right two, right pair? In other words, the individual might claim insurance on a car that is parked in a garage, but he might be driving another car that doesn't have any insurance on that particular automobile. Is that correct, or do you insure the individual?
We insure. It's rather complicated to answer that particular question, Representative Schoon. Basically, we insure both the automobile and the named insured or the operator of the vehicle as long as he's driving his car that is insured by the policy or cars that are on that policy. However, if he has some own autos that are not covered by that policy and he's driving them, he does not have insurance on that car. However, if he's driving somebody else's car with the permission of that owner, then his insurance policy follows him to a non-owned automobile. But to the owned automobile that's not declared on the policy or is that is not a newly acquired automobile, or a replacement automobile is not covered.
Thank you.
Do you hear?
Tom, you so you get it new on insurance. I understand that you have a central bureau or something that you report cancellations to. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
That's not correct. Okay. Why don't you report every cancellation or non-payment on insurance policies to the DMV?
Okay, in 1977, I think it was Representative Anderson, when the mandatory insurance law became effective the first time, they required that any policy that was dropped, any new policy that was dropped within, I think it was the first 90 days of the issuance of that policy, or it could have been 120 days, that the insurance company must notify DMV that that policy had lapsed. They anticipated receiving about 3,000 notifications a month from the insurance companies. Instead, they received 12,000, and they were inundated with paperwork, and then they also found out that many of these people were moving from one insurance company to another insurance company because of maybe a lack of payment of the premium or something to the first insurance company. And in fact, a lot of these people were actually insured when they finally caught up with them, but their records got deeper and deeper, and pretty soon with the 12,000 a month, and they were only geared to handle 3,000, they got so far behind they asked the next legislature to repeal that section of the law, and they did.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. In the computer world, the high-tech world that we're in, wouldn't it be possible that the insurance companies that are doing business in the state of Oregon could, through their computers, direct access to the DMV and eliminate all that paperwork that when you had a cancellation, you merely plugged it into the DMV computer and eliminate all of that?
We could notify DMV, I would assume rather easily, that there was no insurance on that car as far as Oregon Mutual was concerned, but that would not mean that that individual had not gone out and purchased insurance with XYZ Insurance Company, and then as far as DMV would be concerned, they would have to check with that owner to verify whether or not they had in fact picked up coverage from someplace else. That is the time lapse, and that's the crack right now that people are falling through. The Judiciary Committee has introduced a bill, and I'm sorry I can't give you the bill number, it has been printed, that will help plug that loophole that does develop.
Okay,
the state of Oregon requires that each car that does have insurance have $25,000 liability insurance for the injury of any one person, either in their own car or in the other vehicle or in any other cause of accident, pedestrian type, or $50,000 per occurrence, which would mean for everybody in the accident other than the driver. They also require that the individual have $10,000 property damage for the vehicle they ran into or the house they collided with or whatever they damaged that was involving property damage. That's required by the state law. Also included in that is what we call uninsured motorist coverage. That means that if you are injured in an automobile crash by someone who does not carry liability insurance at all, then your own insurance company will pay you up to $25,000 for your injuries or $50,000 for everybody in your car that is injured totally. That's mandated coverages. When we issue an insurance policy, that's automatically part of that policy. In addition to that, we then have what we call personal injury protection. And any car, any private passenger automobile issued in policy issued in the state of Oregon also has $5,000 medical coverage for anybody in that automobile or any pedestrian that you strike. It includes $1,000 funeral expenses. It includes up to $750 a month wage loss if your disability continues for 14 days from the date of the accident, and it lasts, $750 a month lasts for a period of 1 year following the accident. If your injuries disables you from work for 13 days, then you do not receive anything. If it goes the 14th day, then they backdate it to day one and pay you for the full period of time. Also included in that is for people who are not gainfully employed, and they need someone to replace their services around the home, then we have $18 a day for what we call essential services being rendered by someone around the home, being a housekeeper or something of this nature. Then if a person increases their liability insurance beyond the required amount of $25,000 and $50,000, and they want to, they can also increase the uninsured motorist coverage from up to whatever they are carrying on their own liability policy, such as the law requires $25,500, but maybe you want to carry $100,000, $300,000 liability so that you will protect your own financial assets as well as being able to contribute to the other party in case you are at fault a substantial amount of money to cover their injuries. You can also then buy increased underinsurance, as we call it, and uninsured motorist coverage. That protects the people in your car up to the same limits that you have tried to protect the other people in the other car. So you could buy up to $100,000 in your own car or $300,000 for everybody in your car.
Jim?
Those are all first party benefits. And we try to protect ourselves by the first one. Yes.
Tom, do we have any regulation on the charges for that mandated $25,000 uninsured coverage?
The only regulations we have in the state of Oregon is the fact that all insurance companies must file their rates with the insurance commissioner, and we do. But there is no statutory regulation that says we can only charge blank number of dollars for this policy. Pardon?
I said, okay.
Okay.
Just file it away.
Then, of course, we do have the collision insurance, the physical damage, the comprehensive. Those are all optional coverages beyond that. And many companies have many different varieties of the optional coverages. But I've reviewed for you that which is required by the state law. Now, the insurance commissioner's office regulates all the insurance companies in the state, and we feel that they are understaffed. She requested additional staffing from the executive department. She received a portion of that staffing, and Oregon Mutual will be presenting to the Ways and Means Committee a request for additional staffing for a compliance officer or a complaint officer, if you want to. That's how we call them, because they handle the complaints filed against insurance companies. We think she needs at least one more personnel in that department. We also feel that she needs a trainee examiner to go out and examine the financial conditions of the insurance companies doing business in the state of Oregon, because if they are not financially solvent, then the rest of us have to pick up their tabs. And we just got assessed $222,000 on behalf of Oregon Mutual to pick up somebody else's company that went broke in Oregon. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Questions?
Thank you very much.
Mr. Bassinet, the committee is exploring alternatives for the funding for a mandated liquor liability for restaurant and beverage operators. Would you have any comments about there being a $1 additional charge on driver's license, SR-22 filings, uninsured motorist pool, whatever, as a way of funding that?
I'm sorry, I just don't track with the question.
at a method, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, of financing affordable mandated liquor liability for restaurant and tavern owners, of affecting a surcharge of perhaps an additional dollar on SR-22 filings, uninsured motorist, with the end result that if someone's intoxicated and goes out on the highway, etc.
I'll rephrase that, if I may, Mr. Chairman. As I understand, the question is, the state would accumulate a fund of money to assist in paying the insurance premium on a behalf of whoever could not afford their own insurance premium. I have no comment on that question. Sorry, I had to ask such a long question. But
are this good?
Tom, I think it might be important for you to maybe stress to the committee to let them know that your company is an Oregon company headquartered in McMinnville, Oregon, and where else you do business, so that, because of course we have a lot of insurance companies that are doing business in Oregon, of course, but are not necessarily headquartered here. Also, how many employees you have in this sort of thing.
Thank you, Representative Schoon. Oregon Mutual Insurance Company was organized in McMinnville, Oregon in 1894. We're the oldest mutual insurance company in property and casualty west of the Mississippi. We have a premium volume of approximately $60 million, which is small in relationship to property and casualty insurance companies. We are the largest of the domestic insurance companies in the state of Oregon. And by the way, there are three classes of insurance companies. There are the domestic insurance companies, which have their home office in the state in which we're talking about here, Oregon. You have a foreign insurance company, which have their home offices in other states in the United States. And then you have the alien insurance companies, which are headquartered outside the United States. We have 250 employees in McMinnville and in the state of Oregon. About 40% of our premium is generated from within the state. Therefore, 60% come from California, Idaho, and Washington, which means their premium dollars are being brought into the state of Oregon, and therefore we are a capital gathering industry by bringing their premiums into the state of Oregon. We then invest that in a lot of governmental entities within the state. And I think that pretty well answered most of the questions.
I should have listened a little better, but do you do business in Alaska?
No, we do not do. We do it in three Pacific Coast states plus Idaho, just the four western states.
My daughter just told me that who's living in Anchorage now, that some people are referring to Alaska as Oregon North. Might have a potential market.
The insurance climate in the state of Alaska is not conducive to Oregon Mutual moving there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Work session on House Bill 2284. Work session.
That's our work session on House Bill 2284.
A lot of Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you have the amendments for House Bill 2284 before you. I did call the individuals from the microbreweries and read them the amendments last night. They approved them. They processed the council today. And several were going to come down and testify, but with the inclement weather, they said they didn't know if they would be able to make it or not. I've also reviewed the amendments with Mr. Dean Smith, Administrator of OLCC, and he has no concerns, and also with several sponsors of the bill.
Okay.
And you have a copy of the new statute reference in 473 before you also.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Schoon.
Again, this may sound redundant, but would you just go over the amendments with us, please?
Certainly. The amendments to House Bill 2284, the major effects are the following. On line 6 of the bill, section 2.1a, the microbreweries will be permitted, because of the amendments, to manufacture, instead of 10,000 barrels, 25,000 barrels.
Yes, Chairman. Jim, do you have any background on why suddenly they went from 10 to 2.5 times that much? Have the micros grown or something? Are there no other micros? Or?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think they're hopeful of growing. To the winery statute also.
Is that the same? Is that the same?
Yes. Yeah, wineries are gallons, and these are barrels.
25 barrels.
It's not hardly equivalent.
And both on the recommendation that sponsors of the bill and Mr. Smith's testimony before you yesterday, and line 8, section 1B, the requirement that they sell at retail no more than 50%. So they may now sell 100% of their product, if they so choose, on premises. Again, because of the testimony from Mr. Smith and questions by committee members, to bring the Brewery Public House under the taxing requirements from the state of Oregon, that is the amendment that says, for purposes of ORS Chapter 473, you have a copy before you, a Brewery Public House licensee shall be considered to be a manufacturer, and that would require them to pay the tax of $2.60 for 31 barrels, and also require them to post a $1,000 bond. For the discussion to make the fee more equitable with other retail installation, the fee charge of $50 was deleted, and the amount of $250 was inserted in its place. And that fee does include their license to brew or manufacture, wholesale their product, and for retail sales. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are all of the amendments.
Did you do any more research into the, my concern is this tax shelter. Basically, if I was in the restaurant business, I would immediately form a brewery and sell the equipment that I've depreciated out over to the brewery. If you did any more in that area?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sides, in section 473.030, which you have before you, and subsection number 7, by classifying the brewery as a manufacturer, it does provide for tax credits up to the amount of $200,000 in any year. But these are only for items of plant, machinery, or equipment in the direct manufacture of malt beverages, and for nothing else.
But that could be all mixers, all refrigeration units, all everything that you had there, almost in a restaurant, could be in some way, you know, spoons, forks. You couldn't do stoves, ovens, that type of thing.
It's my understanding, and there are people here from the Revenue Department, but again, only the refrigeration were brewery refrigeration equipment, not refrigerators, normal coolers, things like that.
Well, what I'm thinking, obviously the people that were here are very legitimate what they're doing.
Sure.
Is there something that we could add that would not leave any loopholes? I mean, these people are going to be producing at least 100 gallons or barrels or whatever, I would imagine. I don't know. Maybe they aren't, but I would think that you couldn't apply for that tax credit unless you produced over a certain number of barrels.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sines, there undoubtedly, and for someone in the audience that has more information, but again, it's my understanding from checking both the state tax people and IRS, it just simply, if it's not to be used in the direct manufacture of malt beverages, would not be allowed.
Mr. Chairman. You have to get some sort of certificate or license from the OLCC, correct? In order to, so it would be very difficult. You would actually have to, you'd have to be confirmed as a brewery in order to do that, which means that you would have to be manufacturing something and you'd have to meet certain standards in order to do that. So it would seem difficult to just be a restaurant and to take your equipment and declare that you're a brewery. You'd have to be licensed by the...
You must obtain a certificate of approval.
Say you're a brewery and not ever sell any drop. Why don't we just put that in there, that has to have an OLCC license there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sines, it is in the bill. The amendment that says that it includes a certificate of approval.
Okay.
Yeah. Does require that.
Okay. That's my problem.
Mr. Chairman, I move the amendment state 2785 for Legislative Council 2284-1.
Discussion?
Mr. Chairman. Representative
Smith.
I think I would like to ask Mr. Smith what that figure 25,000 means, if that is small or large or medium, if it's still really micro, if he is aware of that, by chance.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Dean Smith, Administrator, OLCC. I wasn't sure I heard the question, sir.
Well, we're getting ready to accept an amendment to change the amount that could be brewed from 10,000 barrels to 25,000 barrels. Now, it appears to me without knowing very much about this, that the original drafters of the bill felt that 10,000 was an upward limit, and that qualified him as a microbrewery, and therefore everything was just fine. And suddenly we see this number increase 2.5 times, and I don't have any idea how much it takes to be a microbrewery or a medium-sized brewery or a Blitz Weinhardt. So do you by chance have any idea whether 25 is still very small?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shum, I don't have much of an idea, but I can convert it to dollars, which at least gives me a handle on it. Our fee for a barrel of beer, which is 31 gallons, is $2.60. So at 10,000, that would be $26,000. Now, as you point out, we're 2.5 times that. So that's 60-some thousand dollars, I guess, that they are talking about in relationship to our beer tax, our privilege tax. I think that's quite small in relationship to something like Blitz. But it sounds pretty big as a former less than 200 gallon a year home winemaker.
Chairman, Lieutenant Scott, we might relate this to the wine industry, which is hard to interpret gallons and barrels, but their limitation is a tax exemption, actually what it amounts to. There are, I'm going to guess, but out of the 40-some small wineries in the state, there are probably 3 or 4 of those that have already exceeded the 25,000 gallon type limit. For example, I'm sure Honeywood, the local winery in Salem, does exceed that, and that's not considered, you know, a really large operation, but sort of perspective.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schoon, in the article you have before you, and I am just discovering this, from the Multnomah Monthly, in an article by Mr. Robin Willis, on page 2, he says that a microbrewery is a tiny operation producing anywhere from 1,000 to 6,000 36-gallon barrels. The statute says 31-gallon barrels, so there is a difference. He says it's an arbitrary figure, but if you compare it to Anheuser-Busch with 50 million compared to 6,000.
I guess I don't have any more questions.
Okay.
I guess the motion before us. Any objections?
Okay.
Oh, yes, we got it.
With regards to Representative Side's concern about somebody selling some equipment to themselves or some such thing as that, I guess that I would have a little concern about somebody maybe incorporating and selling their equipment